third, about 1:35, present Representatives Gruenberg, Taylor, Cotton, and Sun Chair. Before us, right off the bat, we have a House Bill 53, and then we're going to get into House Bill 125 and 121. 53 was back as a proposed committee substitute, and if I could just highlight the changes for the committee as we went through. On page 1, line 10, the word willfully was changed to knowingly.
That was Sun number 1, right?
Right. And I would note on page 2, line 4, there's some penciled in numbers on your proposed CS. There was a mistake made in the drafting that was never changed. Mm-hmm. The motion was to change the page 3, line 3, the posting requirement 5 to 3,000, and the drafter mistakenly just changed that. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we changed knowingly to willfully to knowingly in section 5. And section 5 is repealed and reenacted. And I just let people to look at it. The existing statute says that on a first conviction, on a willful or knowingly and repeated violation of this section which causes death, you can get a fine of $150,000 or imprisonment up to 6 months. And the second conviction after a prior conviction, it's $500,000 imprisonment for not more than 1 year or both. What we've done here is change it to a Class B misdemeanor, which is, again, 90 days, so that's a little less than the 6 months. And then added a sentence on line 16 to say that in addition to the Class B misdemeanor, the commissioner may also assess a civil fine of not more than $150,000. And then the next line is a Class A misdemeanor, which is 1 year, which is the same as the prior statute, or existing statute. And then the commissioner may assess a civil fine for not more than $500,000. So it's my assumption under this language that you have a criminal trial on the misdemeanor statute, and that gets you the jail time. And the civil procedure is within the department's civil procedure, like every other aspect here, for failure to correct violations, for failure to post, or whatever. They have a procedure that they assess civil fines against. That would apply here on this civil fine for if somebody was dead. So the commissioner, Department of Labor, can proceed on a civil basis for issuing a civil fine for an employee cause or a death cause, employee dies. And the DA can proceed on the criminal side under this statute, under a misdemeanor, either Class A, Class B, or if they have other evidence to show it's a felony or a manslaughter or whatever, that they're not restricted from prosecuting that. And that's the legal opinion we have. And Representative Barnes is here on the amendment you offered. That was a specific sentence you had in there that they were not precluded from going to carrying on another criminal charge. Our research shows that they're not anyway, and it's really not necessary to put that language in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I note Representative Barnes is here. Representative Cotton and then Taylor.
In any event, the commissioner would have to wait until a conviction was there before they could assess a civil fine, is that right?
I don't think, though. I think the commissioner can proceed with his civil fine just like he can under any other these other provisions. They have a process in the department. I mean, for issuing, they can issue a civil fine for failing to post a notice. They can issue a civil fine for failure to correct a violation.
But under current law, you take a look at the existing bill there on line 15 on page 2. So the person who violates a provision upon conviction is punishable by a fine and imprisonment. That's the way it is now. It seems like you got a conviction for it, there can be a fine now. And I'm not sure what this does as far as my limited formal legal education.
The record should reflect that the representative is smiling when he says that.
Yeah. Representative Ulmer is also with us. Gail, do you want to join us here so we can finally plow through this?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Gail Horefsky. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Let me just address, if I may, Representative Cotton's question. I see his concern, and I am concerned that it might be a problem, because it says a person is guilty of a misdemeanor, and the commissioner may also assess. And it seems what the committee wants to do is make clear that independently, may also independently assess, not hinging on the misdemeanor conviction. And I think that language is pretty clear on the first part of Section 5, but I'm more concerned. This was redrafted, Mr. Chairman, as you probably recall, by the legislative drafter. So this is not the language that committee counsel and I agreed on Friday. I'm concerned about the language on lines 18 through 21. Mm-hmm. Is guilty if he's subsequently convicted and the commissioner may assess. Seems to me that the assessment of the civil fine could be read to hinge upon the second conviction. And there is a rule of lenity which the court applies when they are construing a criminal statute, in which they say if there's any ambiguity, it is strictly construed against the state and in favor of the defendant. In other words, we'll give the accused a break, and that's a rule of interpretation. And so I think they might look at that and say, well, that looks a little ambiguous. We're going to require the conviction first before we allow the assessment of the civil fine.
There's an assumption you made that I'm not sure it's the committee's intent to do that. We're just trying to clarify between the two, but I agree with you to be consistent on line 20. There should be a period after the word death, the word and struck, and a capital T on the.
And the word also should be inserted between may and assess. And I was going to make that amendment.
Okay, that gets us to the point that, okay, now both of these sections are consistent. Now, that isn't necessarily what the committee's intent is. So
That's what I want to sort of get my, I want to understand what the current law is.
Okay.
On a couple of points here. One of them is, under existing law, can the commissioner assess a fine without a conviction?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now,
To me, it doesn't really read that way, but
right.
If that's true,
what does this mean then when they say upon conviction is punishable by a fine or by imprisonment? On existing law, 095E, it's in the original bill, it's on line 15 there. I'd say that's ambiguous.
I think it's real clear under the CS that they could get in a civil fine in addition to the criminal. I read the same way you do, Sam, in the original law. Maybe that's the way they've been doing it, but boy, I think it's a close reading of it.
Has there been fines assessed without convictions?
That's my understanding. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Thorne, do you have a...
We have never issued a criminal willful.
Pardon me?
We have never issued a criminal willful violation.
They only go civilly.
I mean, we've never got to the point where we can find enough evidence to do a criminal willful.
So there's never been a fine under E?
There's never been a conviction.
Have you
Has
issued
ever been
fine?
A fine?
We have issued fines for willful violations.
As a result of the authority under 095E, you've issued fines?
Under A, not under E. We've used A.
You've never used E, so A, 095.
That's section
A.
One of the bill.
Okay.
Representative Taylor,
yeah,
you
that
had
is different. So
you
have
a question.
You're changing it then.
Well, no, I appreciate the chair holding off getting to my concerns because I don't believe I've heard the answer to Representative Cotton's concerns, and I feel pretty strongly about those too. Just as I think the chair has implied that they may be going beyond through their interpretation. Where the legislature intended to go in the first place. And my questions go like this. What is the history, since we got into OSHA, what has the history been of criminal convictions? Apparently there have been none, from what he said.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The next shot is, how do you put a corporation into jail? Do we go up to the manager?
No, there's a special statute that says, it's in Title 11 or 12, John, you can find it. It says where the defendant is a corporation and talks about fines only. Isn't that true?
Well, then everybody that has employees definitely ought to incorporate immediately. Otherwise,
I think the evidence has to be there before you could do it. So, I mean, that's...
Does this also apply to municipal and state? Well, we have workers that die. Does OSHA enforce laws against us? And if they don't...
Yes,
they do.
We fine the state?
Yes.
That probably does a lot of good.
You've actually fined the state or municipality?
Okay.
My bottom line to this thing is I still don't believe we need it when you've got a history of violations now and fines where they've averaged 170 some bucks a fine, and now you're going to jack them to $1,100 as a base.
That's a different question.
Okay, that's a different question. I want to work on Sam's question here, because I want to get it clear in my mind, too. Max, to Section 5 interpretation?
Yeah, I think that there's another difference here also. And Mr. Refke, you correct me if I'm wrong. Under the present language in the bill, Section 5, it says, upon conviction, is punishable by a fine, etc. In order to get the right now $10,000 fine, you have to have a criminal conviction. They are entitled to all criminal safeguards, and it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you do, you can be sentenced to imprisonment of up to 6 months or a fine of up to $10,000 or both, right?
Mr. Chairman.
Isn't that
correct? That's my understanding.
Okay. Here, under the CS, it would be a civil fine, not a criminal fine, but a civil fine. Under the Baker versus City of Fairbanks case and the progeny, it's a substantial enough fine, you'd have a right to a jury trial. But since it's a civil fine, all you have to do is show by a preponderance of the evidence, or at least the Supreme Court's never decided that a civil fine is entitled to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I would think that at least it's an open question. My gut feeling is it's only preponderance of the evidence, but we'd have a right to a jury trial on that. Is there a difference in standard of proof since you've labeled it a civil fine as opposed to a criminal penalty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenberg, I am not an expert in OSHA law. The OSHA people are up in Anchorage. I'm here because this is criminal stuff. My impression of civil fines is, generally speaking, you're right, they only have to be proven by preponderance of the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But so I will say yes to your question, but with the qualification, you understand that I don't do OSHA work, so I don't know what the history. I mean, maybe that it goes in front of the administrative board as opposed to a court jury. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to hear that at all.
Constitutionally, I guess I'm just raising by the insertion of the word civil fine. I think there may be a question as to a lower standard of proof, but beyond a reasonable doubt is a much higher standard than a preponderance.
Yeah, I would put on the record that that's what this is. It was my opening statement that this commissioner may also assess a civil fine as the same type of language that is used in the rest of the statute under civil fines for failure to post, civil fines for failure to violate or to correct violations, and that it would be the same procedure in the department, which is they issue the fine and then they have an administrative appeals procedure, which eventually I think you get into Superior Court, but it's a different burden of proof. I just want to lay out the committee, I have no personal heartburn with the existing language as it came into the committee in CS for House Bill 53, which I think requires, my reading requires a criminal conviction, and then the judge is left with the option of adding on $150,000 worth of penalties. Where I think the language in the CS is different. It says you can prosecute them for a misdemeanor and the commissioner can proceed with the civil process for a civil fine of up to $150,000. I think it's a policy call. It's one that the committee ought to make, and hopefully we can make it today.
May I ask a follow-up question? If you go through this appeal process and if there's a $150,000 civil penalty or whatever you call it, would there be a constitutional right to a de novo jury trial at some point in there?
I don't know.
Representative Taylor.
The only testimony I think the committee has is this has never been used. We're really sitting on talking about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. The frightening part is we may create one now that is going to be used. And is there real need to start throwing our people in jail on these things since they haven't had a need for it for over 10 years? I suggest that the committee would take a hard look at the entire section and eliminate it unless there is something in, quote, federal law where we have to be stricter than the feds do, or at least equal to. And we haven't had any testimony on that, but I'd like to hear from somebody in the Department of Labor about whether or not that's required in the federal law for us to run our own OSHA program.
Mr. Chairman, there is a lady up in Anchorage, Janda Young, who does this OSHA stuff, and I spoke with her by phone right before the committee hearing. I think it would be very good for the committee to be able to hear from her, either through a telephone link up or you want to do a conference call, whatever. She expressed to me, for example, some serious concern about the use of the word knowing in the civil penalty instead of willful, saying that based on her enforcement experience, it would be more difficult to prove knowing in the civil context than in the willful. that's her area, that's not my area, I can't address that. Regarding the criminal stuff, the present law says willful. The reason it's never used is because willful in criminal law, as opposed to civil law, equates to intentional, and that's the highest standard of proof, and it's almost impossible to get the evidence to prove that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's one of the reasons behind the impetus to change it is it doesn't work now. If you're going to have criminal penalties, they ought to at least work, or else it's just an illusory thing on the books that nobody can take seriously. The other final issue I think that Representative Taylor raised is another one I think that Mr. Young could address, Mr. Chairman, and that is the issue of we have to be stricter than the feds, I'm told, or else we stand to lose a lot of federal money. And Dr. Thorne brought up to me a concern that I was not aware of since I don't do OSHA stuff, that this change to Class B misdemeanor, which committee counsel and I put in so we'd have the graduated things, but plus it would fit into the criminal law, she's concerned that that might, in fact, be less onerous than the federal statute, because the federal statute requires 6 months and misdemeanors are 90 days. And there's all kinds of issues here that somebody who does OSHA enforcement, I think, should address.
I have a proposed solution. I'd like to take the proposed CS, take the original Section 5 that was in the bill as it came in to the committee, CS for House Bill 53-S, and place it into this CS. That leaves all the original language as it is in the statute today, except for the numbers have changed from 10 to 150 and from 20 to 500.
Except for willfully.
And the willfully to knowingly.
Okay. So we're changing the word willfully to knowingly.
And I'd like to move the, this is a proposed CS in front of us, to move the HESS Section 5 into this bill. That creates the least amount of changes. And Representative Barnes.
Are we going to go back to willful in the bill rather than knowingly?
No. Stay at knowingly.
Mr. Chairman.
Max.
Just so we have a document in front of us, I'll move if you want a motion on that for the purpose of discussion only. But I do have some comments, so I'll make the motion that we adopt the modified CS. And that's Kramer 221, but instead of the five Section 5 version, we take the Hess version, substituting in that Section 5 the word knowingly for the word willfully on line 12. And I do have a comment, though. And that is, since apparently there is some problem.
There's a motion there. Is there any objection to that?
No.
Okay, hearing none, that's adopted.
With respect to something you said about what Ms. DeHart said, do we need to have some testimony on the fact that it should remain willfully and not use the word knowingly? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, what Ms. Young told me was that there are 40 other states who use the word willfully in their civil penalty as opposed to criminal, and that's also the word used in the federal statute. She informed me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bloomberg, that in the case law which has developed under OSHA enforcement standards, in civil law, willful is interpreted to mean more or less recklessly. So she was very, very concerned, and that was her main concern, was that the switch to knowingly would raise the standard of proof in the civil provision as it is interpreted by a whole body of civil case law. And she felt that might put us out of compliance with the federal standards, because then in our civil penalties, we would have a higher standard than the feds, and therefore wouldn't meet their standard of proof.
May I respond to that, Mr. Chairman?
So Grunberg, then Taylor.
We have here, if we look here, Section 1, I can see her point there. And maybe we should then be back to willfully in Section 1. Section 2 is also civil. Section 3 appears to be civil. Section 4 is civil. Section 5, the one that we're dealing with, though, is criminal.
Right.
Section 6 seems to be criminal. Section 7 is civil. So my first question to you is, with respect to Sections 5 and 6, does her argument still apply?
Mr. Chairman, the position that I expressed to committee chairman after the hearing on Friday was, from a criminal point of view, our position is that word ought to be recklessly, not knowingly. I specifically asked Ms. DeYoung about that, and she said in the criminal area, they would bow to criminal division expertise on this because she understands that the terms are defined for criminal law purposes in Title 11, whereas for civil purposes, that definition wouldn't necessarily apply, or if it did, it would raise the standard. So I think that, if I'm understanding your question, sir, this committee could justifiably make a distinction and put willfully in the civil penalty and either knowingly or reckless in the criminal, and that distinction would make sense and there would be a valid purpose behind it.
Representative Taylor.
I'm kind of anxious about this piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman, because most of what we're talking about here is being based upon what Ms. Horesky guesses might be his own attitude on whether or not we're in or out of compliance with federal law, can have devastating effect upon this program, whether or not it's going to work. I think that's pretty, he's raised some pretty significant questions, and until we hear from, and I still haven't had the answer in yet to Mr. Representative Cotton's question.
We solved that one.
I think I'm satisfied. If we go back to the other way, that way you're not changing existing
law.
You're just raising the fine, but it still requires a conviction. I would request.
We know it requires a conviction, and that's in our intent here.
Mr. Chairman, I know you don't want to keep this bill over, but I would request, for my illumination, maybe some sort of a matrix that defines knowingly, willfully, recklessly under circumstances related to civil cases, related to criminal cases, which one is requires the highest proof of what's that word?
Intent.
Intent.
Okay. Intentionally, there's another word. And whether or not we're in, this seems like, I'm not able to make an intelligent decision about whether that'll be willfully, knowingly, or recklessly, or whether, as you suggested, that'll be one for civil and one for criminal.
Could we have Ms. Young be prepared to testify by telephone?
I can tell you what the differences are. It takes less to prove reckless than it does to prove knowingly. In the criminal division, if you're a DA in the prosecute world, you like to be able to prove reckless because it doesn't take as much as it takes to prove knowingly. So
okay,
I understand
so
the argument.
Is a higher standard then.
Right.
Knowingly is higher than reckless.
And what about willful?
It's higher than willful. Too.
Willful is undefined
they
in
don't
our
use
statutes.
Willful.
We don't use willful.
But everybody else does.
Feds might
do.
Use willful.
For criminal purposes. Yeah.
We don't use willful.
For crimes. We use it for civil matters.
Okay, so
I think Max has probably got a point that if we're going to stay on the civil side, we ought to stay with willfully.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate chop the baby in half routine here. So in that case, on this CS, on page 1, line 10, we ought to change knowingly to willfully, and I'd make that motion.
I would object for purposes of discussion, Mr. Chairman. The discussion I would raise is that we don't know that we're missing a thing.
Right.
It may very well be wise to make the law consistent and apply consistently in all phases here.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking of something that's very penal in nature. Whether it's civil or not, it's still a significant fine. And we have increased the significance of these fines by 1,000% without any testimony indicating that it's justified or needed, in my opinion. But
okay. But anyway, this does make it consistent. Doesn't change it. Stays the same there. So I'd move that change, knowingly, or willfully to knowingly. No, knowingly to willfully. To what it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
No objection, that's adopted. Now, I don't know.
How big
I have a real issue if we want to stay and take more testimony, if it makes any difference on the criminal side or what do you want to do.
I'd say, Mr. Chairman, that we should make it knowingly. Recklessly is too small, is too low a standard when you're going to sock somebody with fines of this type. It should be known, in my opinion.
Well, I agree.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Cotton,
please compare willfully in regard to the criminal penalties as to how that might be interpreted and knowingly.
You mean intentionally?
No.
No.
The current statute says willfully.
Right.
That's
or
nowhere,
Section 5.
That's
right.
Nowhere defined. In
but it's they're discussed. Somebody would have to interpret it at some point.
Right.
You would interpret it as intentionally.
Okay, so intentionally now. So compare it intentionally to knowingly.
John can find that. That's in in the section.
Are we making it a, we're making it a greater burden on the state if you change it from willfully to knowingly?
Yes. Lower. Intentionally is the highest, knowingly is next, recklessly is below that.
Okay.
Negligently is below that.
Willfully, so like intentionally.
Willfully and intentionally, according to Gaylor.
In the criminal world, they're defined about
okay.
the same.
Right. So.
But what?
Intentionally.
I've got knowingly. You've
it's right out of there. And then here's intentionally. And here's
recklessly.
All right.
Those are our three
criminal
standards.
Criminal negligence is one.
So if we're going to put them in jail or subject them to these relatively high fines.
By the way, if you, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the bill, at Section 6, the term there is knowingly on making a false statement.
Yeah, that's existing language.
Yeah, I realize it's slightly a different kind of a crime, but they use the word knowingly there.
Makes me feel comfortable that the existing statute has both those words in it.
And the existing statute has never once been enforced
criminally
because in the history of the state.
Because of the fact that they're saying willfully, which relates to intentionally, and that means that they not only violated, but they did it because they wanted to hurt somebody. And that's why I think it's smart to move down to knowingly.
No, not because they wanted to hurt somebody.
That's what the law says.
Because they intended to
cause a particular result.
A piece of equipment.
Right.
Or they intended not to shore up the side walls of the...
Okay.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. It's a general intent, not a specific intent.
That's right.
Crime, right?
That's right.
Or is it? I mean, that's
a specific intent crime. Couldn't be.
From the lay side of the table, Representative
yeah.
R.
As far as not having this used before, that doesn't really cause me a great heartburn because this is very serious and it's held for those that are the most serious violators. So that I would hope that it's not being violated at all. And if it is, I think we ought to sock them as heavy as we can. It shouldn't be used.
It might be a tribute to our employers that it's never been used. Somewhere. Okay, any other discussion here?
Especially if it's been I guess then we all ought to vote to reward our employers by increasing the penalty amount by, what is it? $25,000, $150,000, and $1,025. Guarantee you that 1,000 is. If you don't believe it, ask any employer in your district. We haven't had testimony from the employer section around here. All we've really heard from is labor.
You're talking about Section 5 or something?
No, he's into Section 1.
2.
Talking about the whole thing.
That's the same thing. They basically raised the floor up to 1,000.
Well, that's Section 2 that does
it. Yeah. There hasn't been any motions on that.
You still taking yours?
I'm not going to make any motions.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should keep it online in Section 5, the word knowingly.
Well, that's the way it is. That's the way it is right now. Okay, we have a CS in front of us. Any other discussion on the committee?
I move that we move it out with individual recommendations.
There's a motion to move the committee substitute for House Bill 53 Judiciary as amended with individual recommendations.
Objection.
Any discussion?
I place that motion on the floor. I want to amend the committee to CF line 3.
That is 3,000 now.
I know. I'm going to amend it to 1,000.
Okay, let's see.
Isn't that what the strike? That's cutting down.
Right.
So you move to eliminate Section 7?
Yeah.
Yeah, basically the motion, so parliamentary-wise, you have a motion to move the bill, I guess. You want to withdraw your motion, Fran?
Oh, reluctantly withdraw my motion.
Okay.
Yeah, let's get our act together here, those who want to make motions.
Okay. The motion by Representative Taylor to delete Section 7. Any discussion?
And you might as well add in Section 3 because that's the one I'm going to make.
Which one's that?
Delete Section 3 also.
Okay, Section 3. And Section 7. Is there any discussion?
And 4.
I object.
Okay, The motion is to move, remove section 3, 4, and 7.
You want to split them up separate votes? I'm happy to do that. I'm just
You're making the motions.
I'm just trying to speed it up for you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I figure I'm going to get
votes
on this one anyhow.
Is there any
on the record?
Is there any question? There's objection. Those in favor of the motion to delete sections 3, 4, and 7?
I'm abstaining because I didn't hear the discussion.
No yellow buttons.
Leave existing law where it is $1,000 instead of increasing.
This is Representative Taylor's motion to
leave it just this law. Okay.
On those three sections.
On those three sections. Okay. It would keep the civil penalties identical as in existing law in sections 3, 4, and 7. Those in favor, raise your hand. Representative Taylor and Barnes opposed. Ulmer, Grunberg, Navarre, Cotton, and Son. Motion fails.
Mr. Chairman, I have a technical question. I don't think that there's a necessity for Section 8. I think that would apply just naturally anyway. You couldn't apply it to violations prior to the effective date of the Act, because that would be unconstitutional ex post facto law.
Yeah, I like it there to tell the department, it's real clear where we want this to apply to. I think you're right, but it's the violations that occur on or after the effective date, not that the penalty hasn't been assessed yet.
The thing I'm concerned about is that we're going to have a lot of different bills that come through here with penalty sections. And we've had a lot in the past. And this is the only time I have ever seen a clause like this.
No, we did it with the tort bill last year.
It doesn't go into the statutes.
It's just
I know, but it's still
law.
Part of the law and goes into the back. It still is part of this. I'm concerned about the precedent this sets.
No, I think we put an effective date clause on the tort bill last year. It only applied to actions that arose
after a certain date.
Yeah, but that may yes, that did. But here we're talking about criminal stuff. And I just, it's a matter of form, some kind of consistency here. I'm not going to make a big thing about it, but I think it's a bad precedent to start setting this, because that's a matter of law anyway. And if you feel that it should be in there, I'll bow to you, but my recommendation is that we don't have it in there, because that's a matter of law. That's the way it would be anyway. And it's bad precedent.
Representative Navarre?
I want to offer a motion on page 3 of the bill to amend the section. Section 7, line 3,000
to 2,000.
5,000. No, it's 3. There was a typo in here when we voted to make it 3 last time. Okay, the motion by Representative Navarre, page 3, line
3,
is to reduce the penalty, maximum penalty for failure to post from 3,000 to 2,000. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Okay, motion's adopted then.
Representative Son, may I try my earlier
motion? I appreciate it if you would.
Before you do that,
Representative Taylor.
I move to amend the CS deleting sections 1 through 8 and inserting in their stead that we delete title 18, section 60.010, etc. Through.
I think that might be dilatory. I don't know.
No, through Article 1.
I'm not sure you can do it under this this title.
It would be an act of violation.
Object. And the reason for that, thank you for the objection, I have an opportunity to discuss it. The reason for the
I was real close to ruling the motion out of order.
Is to eliminate the state OSHA department and allow the federal government to take back over that function and do it with their 12 employees instead of us continuing to fund 27 employees on the state payroll to do the same act.
Question?
Got a nice whistle.
All those in favor of the motion? Representative Taylor, those opposed? Balance of the committee, motion fails. Okay, Representative Ulmer?
I move that the committee move out the amended committee substitute with individual recommendations.
Okay, motion to move committee substitute for House Bill 53 as amended with individual recommendations. Any objection? Hearing none, the CS moves.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. Prompt action on that bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd request that we take up the private prosecutor next, moving the other way. I think that that'll be less discussion.
You gotta be kidding.
Come on now, let the chairman handle it.
Okay, here we go. House Bill 121. Private prosecution. This is a simple one-line bill. On the other one, did that
tell?
Oh, I'm sorry. Max, we got a teleconference on the other one.
Oh, okay.
House Bill 125.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dial them up. Okay.
Can we do the other one while we're dialing? John, I think we can be pretty quick on the other one.
I don't know anything about it, so I'm going to...
Okay, let's go. Will, you're dialing
them
up?
I'm dialing them up.
Okay. While we're dialing up on the teleconference, let's look at House Bill 121. It is a bill repealing a provision relating to payment of costs by private prosecutor. There's apparently a statute in our state that is somewhat ambiguous in terms of allowing the payment order of payment of a private prosecutor to pay costs for malicious prosecution without probable cause. The intention by the cover letter was that the bill originally was to allow people to obtain costs for being maliciously prosecuted. It's being interpreted, I guess, in some areas of the state as a private right to prosecute people privately rather than going through the Attorney General and bring causes of action, criminal causes of action against individuals. Gail, do you want to testify on this? Or?
I'd be glad to.
I don't know if you're here on this bill or
yes,
not.
Mr. Chairman, the
statute's a simple repealer of that section, and I don't know if the committee wants to act on it without testimony or listen
no,
to
I'd
it.
Like, I could have a question.
I thought you said it was quick, Max.
It is.
I'd be glad to ask
a question. Are we tuned in here?
She's on, yeah.
Okay. We'll just ask her to stand by for a moment here while we deal with this other bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Max, go ahead.
Yeah, my question relates to footnote 2 in the letter of transmittal. And I, in family law, on a number of occasions, have been involved in seeing situations where somebody goes after what would be technically criminal contempt in the context of a family law case. My question is, and I think this is a good bill, but if we pass it, is that going to preclude bringing private prosecutions for criminal contempt?
Mr. Chairman, my impression is, Representative Greenberg, the answer to that is no. The Attorney General's office, especially the criminal division, are never involved in those, in the context of a, when you're talking about, thank you, when you're talking about the context of a domestic prosecution, those are going on now to the extent they are, and it's my impression that it's very rare without any involvement from the Attorney General's office or the state. So to the extent that the court allows it now under its inherent powers and under the contempt provision of Title 9, that would continue to operate the same way. Our position is that this statute does not authorize private prosecutors. Private prosecutors do not exist. The statute is very confusing, and at the request of the court, we introduced, that is, we, the Department of Law, introduced this bill. So the repeal of this statute would not affect the other procedures which are already in place under other provisions in Title IX, which the court already authorizes and allows.
Hey, just one more question, Mr. Chairman. If we do pass House Bill 121, do you think it would be at all important for us to have a letter of intent to that effect? That this is not meant to affect, for example, people prosecuting private and criminal contempt. Do you think that would be necessary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenberg, no, I don't think it would be.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions, no objection to that.
Thank you. Is there any other questions on this bill?
May I make a motion?
Yeah, I have several.
Uh-huh. Is this on House Bill 121, Representative Barnes?
Mm-hmm. I was busy reading 125, and I just realized we were over to 121.
Well, okay.
Sorry.
If you want to hold those questions, we'll just take testimony on 125.
Well, that's fine. I know the speaker.
Okay. Let's take our testimony on 125 now, if we could. Who are we tuned in with? Okay. Janet, do you want to go ahead on House Bill 125?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity to offer testimony. I appreciate your accommodating my schedule. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janet Bradley. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. House Bill 125, which you have before you, has been introduced by Governor Cooper at the request of the commission. The commission supports this bill, and in fact, it is the number one legislative priority for the Human Rights Commission. House Bill 125 represents not only the governor's desire and the commission's desire for a prejudice-free society, but it's also the result of about 3.5 years of effort by a discriminatory harassment task force, which was formed in 1983. Back at that time, the Human Rights Commission joined with the local Anchorage Commission, that is the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission, in forming a task force composed of community-based representatives. And we have been working with that task force in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Justice Community Relations Service in Seattle. There are about 30 members on our mailing list, and we have been working with that group, which is a group of, as I mentioned, constituents. The purpose of the task force originally, when it met, was to determine if there was a need for legislation in the state of Alaska, and if there was a need to garner support for the introduction and passage of that legislation. The task force has also been collecting information about the kinds of problems which might be addressed by a bill. The task force held a public meeting back in 1983, determined that there was a need for such legislation, and in fact, the bill that you have today is the third attempt to pass discriminatory harassment legislation. The first bill, which was introduced by Senator Josephson, passed the Senate but died when the legislature adjourned. 2 years ago, Governor Sheffield introduced a bill which was much expanded from the bill that you have before you today. There were problems with Josephson's bill and problems with Governor Sheffield's bill, which mostly focused on the criminal sections of the legislation. Those problems, those technical problems of the criminal section of the bill, have been eliminated. The bill which you are considering has only a civil right of action. And I'm sure that Representative Grunberg, who was one of the House Judiciary Committee members last year, is well aware of the kinds of problems that he brought up and that Representative Clarkson brought up about the criminal section of the bill. Well, what we have today, House Bill 125, deals only with the civil side. We believe there may still be a need for a criminal penalty, but that's not the issue that's before us today. What the Human Rights Commission sees as the issue is the opportunity to send a clear message throughout Alaska that conduct involving discriminatory harassment is not tolerated in the state. Now, I mentioned earlier we have been working with the U.S. Department of Justice Community Relations Service. That office has been quite active in the Pacific Northwest, which, as some of you may know, has become a hotbed of right-wing activity, extremist activity, paramilitary groups, posse comitatus, and other sorts of groups which breed on economic recession, which breed on religious and racial intolerance and ethnic hatred. We don't want that kind of activity here in Alaska. There is some evidence that there are isolated incidents of discriminatory harassment in Alaska, and the Human Rights Commission and the task force has been alarmed by that. The legislation that we are proposing today can be viewed as a law and order bill. It's a bill which gives special rights to the victims of discriminatory harassment to seek justice in court. In the Commission's view, House Bill 125 is in fact a peace and harmony bill. It stands for the proposition that Alaskans should be free from physical injury or property damage because of certain protected class status. And if the bill passes, a person who violates the rights of a protected person can be brought to court in an attempt to obtain restitution by the affected party. There is one section of the bill that the commission is very favorable toward, and that is the responsibility for a party who files a complaint or who answers a complaint to send an informational copy on of the executive director of the commission. The purpose of that reporting section is to afford the Human Rights Commission and the task force an opportunity to monitor the number of incidents and the kinds of incidents of discriminatory harassment in the state. The reason for the monitoring is that we believe that we would be able to develop zero fiscal note on this bill. The reason for the zero fiscal note is what information the Human Rights Commission would gather and monitor. We are presently gathering those incidents and monitoring those incidents, and we do not anticipate any additional responsibility under this bill. It does not deal with our statute. It deals with our public education responsibility. Discriminatory harassment is a national problem, and I wish we could say that Alaska is free from this kind of problem, but unfortunately, that does not seem to be the case. We urge you to pass this bill because we see it as an opportunity for the legislature to speak out and to empower individuals who are the victims of discriminatory harassment to seek justice in the courts. I am hoping that at the next hearing of this bill, that we will be able to gather representatives from the community who've been working on the Discriminatory Harassment Task Force to offer testimony and to urge you, as the Commission does, to support and seek passage of this legislation. I'll be happy to answer any questions from the committee at this time.
Representative Cotton and Taylor.
Yeah, Janet, Sam Cotton here. A couple questions. Line 23 discusses other remedies available under law. I guess I'm not sure exactly what that would mean. And I'm curious about the list here. Is it meant to be exclusive of any other causes? What about political beliefs, for example?
Political beliefs was at one time, I believe, in the bill. The Human Rights Commission knows that these particular protected classes are ones that are experiencing problems. I don't know about political beliefs. We have no experience in that area. With respect to other remedies that might exist, it might be possible, for example, for someone who is experiencing difficulties on the job to also file a complaint with the Human Rights Commission and to seek relief from, let's say, discrimination on the job, some type of discriminatory harassment. We, however, would not be able to award punitive damages. And were an individual to go to court, that would be a separate action from anything the Human Rights Commission might do. The typical kind of harassment complaint that we might look at would have to do with harassment on the job. And usually the relief in that instance is cease and desist. But there typically are no actual or punitive damages involved.
I guess the question is, if somebody causes physical injury or damages a person's property, whatever their intent was, I guess I'm not clear on what sort of remedy I might have as a private citizen. Could I sue them for physical injury, or?
I believe that's the intention of this bill.
You don't think I can do that right now, though?
Not for discriminatory reasons, and that's why we think that the bill is really necessary. The classic example that's given, and this happened, for example, in the state of Maryland before legislation was passed, a person with a religious bigotry would place a cross in the yard of a Jewish family and burn the cross, or perhaps in a black family, or place swastikas on a church. The damages that would be available, absent a bill of this kind, would only be for malicious destruction of property or some other kind of property damage, when in fact, it's really a more heinous crime than simply lighting a fire in somebody's yard or defacing the paint job of a synagogue. It really expresses a kind of behavior that is of a different quality and deserves a different kind of punishment.
Thank you. Representative Taylor?
Yeah, can you tell me, please, what other states have enacted laws of this type?
There is legislation in the Pacific Northwest, in Washington, in Oregon, and in Idaho. In Maryland, the Maryland legislature gave seed money to a national institute to begin the research and develop policies and give recommendations to groups around the country to deal with the growing problem of discriminatory harassment. I know there's legislation in Maryland, and I know that there are groups active all along the Eastern Seaboard. Last fall, I had the opportunity to attend a workshop dealing with this problem that was given at the Human Rights Workers National Conference. And at that time, I had the opportunity to hear Joan Weiss, who is the director of the National Institute Against Prejudice and Violence. This is the one which is presently operating in the state of Maryland. A man by the name of Earl Schoenhoster, who is the Southeast Regional Director from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and Leonard Zeskind, Acting Director of the Center for Democratic Renewal, another individual by the name of Christina Davis, who's a community educator from North Carolina, who's active in an organization there called North Carolinians Against Racist and Religious Violence. And obviously, we don't have the magnitude of problems that they have in those areas, but this is a problem which has been identified nationally. It is a problem that has been worked on in the Pacific Northwest, where there are these groups who are dedicated to violence and to hate activity against certain groups because of their religious or racial or ethnic background. And it's rather a frightening situation that we think has a potential here in Alaska. So we look to the bill as being preventive legislation to the extent that we don't have a large problem here. We're concerned about sending a message that we don't want the problem here at all.
Mr. Speaker, I asked you a real short, simple question, and I hope to get a real short, simple answer, and you never gave it to me. How many states have passed into law bills of this type? Can you answer that, please?
I know I'm familiar with the ones in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and I can get that information for you and send it down to the committee. I don't know of others. I know there is a lot of activity in this area, and I'm familiar with the legislation in the Pacific Northwest.
And as far as you know, there's three states or maybe four?
In the Pacific Northwest. I do not know about the rest of the country.
Okay. Now, what... I guess you gave us the most common example is the burning of the guy's yard up with the cross or something like that. Are there not adequate remedies at law right now to take care of that very problem?
There are criminal penalties, as I understand it, for destruction of property. But I don't believe that that really addresses the problem. I really believe that the kind of activity we're talking about, which is motivated by racial bigotry and hatred of persons that the bill would be designed to correct, is really a different kind of a problem.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but the legislation that's before us talks in terms of a civil penalty. If we're going to be serious about this, shouldn't we enhance or increase the criminal penalties on people that are doing these criminal acts, like burning a cross in somebody's yard? All you're talking about is, at the most, under an amendment that Mr. Grunberg's even shown me here today, all you're talking about is three times the cost of replacing the grass.
We have attempted in the last two legislatures to pass a criminal section of this bill, and it was fraught with technical difficulties because of the structure of the bill. It was the thinking of the commission when it approached Governor Cooper that this might be an opportunity for us to get the civil section of the bill passed, to monitor the number of incidents, to evaluate how we might be able to come back to the legislature with more information and more specifics, and to eventually get a criminal section passed.
Representative Grunberg and then Cotton.
Ms. Bradley, this is Max Grunberg. I have a couple of questions for you.
Yes, what can I do for you?
Okay. Contrasting the language in Section 650 sub A versus the present language in the State Human Rights Act, there are some categories that are in here that are not in there, and there are categories that are in present law that are not in here. For example, sexual orientation appears in here, but it's not in the Human Rights Act. And there are some categories in the Human Rights Act that are not in here, and I'd like to focus on those for a minute. You could have discrimination because of a person's age. Don't you think that should be in here too?
We have not identified that as a problem, but I do not see any opposition to adding age to those categories.
You are also familiar with situations where somebody may be discriminated against or harassed because their pregnancy, something like that. That has occurred too, hasn't it? And that's protected under the Human Rights Act, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but we have a decision at the Human Rights Commission which states, it's the Debbie Painter versus the Ketchikan-Gateway Borough School District, that pregnancy and sex were considered by the commission to be included in sex since it was added to the statute in 1969. However, again, should you wish to add that, I don't see that there would be a problem with that.
Okay, I think that to make certain that this is congruent with the Human Rights Act, we ought to consider that. And the same with marital status and changes in marital status too, don't you agree?
I'm not troubled by adding those. I'm trying to recollect if there are situations which have come to our intention, to our attention, that present problems which need to be addressed. Quite honestly, Representative Greenberg, the original concept of our bill several sessions ago was to deal mostly with the areas of racial and religious and ethnic harassment. But the Human Rights Commission does not oppose having more classes added as there is the need. So, as I say, I don't see a problem with adding it. I don't know what situation it would reach to cover.
Okay. In subsection B, right now it seems to me, and I would suspect if we did a little research, we'd find some courts that have expanded the common law to cover this. It seemed to me that right now, there are common law torts, for example, for the intentional infliction of emotional distress or the negligent infliction of emotional distress, and that would cover this sort of a thing, and you could get actual and even punitive damages for that. The problem I see is that under Alaska law, since we passed the Tort Reform Act last year, to get punitive damages, you have to show clear and convincing evidence. And this particular statute, when it talks about punitive damages, doesn't change that standard. What I'm thinking of is an amendment to lines 18 and 19 that would change that first sentence to read as follows, and I would like your comment on this proposed amendment. It would read as follows: a prevailing plaintiff in an action brought under this section shall be awarded 3 times the amount of their actual damages, or $2,000, whichever is greater. In other words, it would provide minimum damages of $2,000 or treble their actual damages if, for example, there was structural damage to a building or whatever we're talking about, or physical injury. Would you care to comment?
Well, I would like to consider that and discuss that with our commissioners who will be meeting on Friday and Saturday and get their guidance. When legislation comes before the commission, the commissioners are kept very well informed on major changes or additions, and I would like to consult with them. However, I do not see any big problem with that, and I just need to consider that a little bit. Perhaps you and I could talk some more about it subsequent to this hearing.
Please give my office a call. Thank you.
Private meeting.
Representative Cotton.
I guess.
Taylor.
I just want to make sure I understand what it means to bring an act, maintain an action. Does that just mean, what exactly does that mean?
You have to file a lawsuit.
So you file a lawsuit, and if a judge finds that you are correct, then without any limits, the judge would, is there a standard that the judge would have to follow as far as what he could or couldn't award?
Well, in this case, you'd have to award actual damages, and he's allowed punitive damages, but Representative Gruenberg is correct.
But if you, the way it reads right now with punitive damages, I guess I just want to understand what could possibly happen. What's an example of a limit that might
be
reached?
There is no limit on the punitive damage section here. It's whatever the judge would find that is appropriate punishment for doing the crime in the and they've gone from $0 and $1 up to into the millions of dollars in some cases.
So where would this action be brought?
Brought in Superior Court.
And then that person could go to the Court of Appeals, or does it go to the Supreme Court?
It could be brought in District Court or Superior Court, depending on how much damages. I think there's a $25,000 limit in District Court. So a lot of these may be District Court actions.
So, but if the person, would he ask for a certain level of punitive damage?
Yeah, and he'd have
to. So if it was more than $25,000, would it automatically go to Superior Court?
Right. Yeah, you don't have to, if you may, if I may, Mr. Chairman. In your prayer for relief in the complaint, you can say an amount to be proven at trial.
Mm-hmm.
But if the amount, let's say you're in district court. This is in any case, Sam. If you're in district court and the jury comes back and awards you $75,000, the most that they would be allowed jurisdictionally to give you is $25,000, and all a defendant would have to come in and ask for what's called a remitter, in other words, to knock down the jury award. The most the district court in any case can give you right now is $25,000, and under that impeachment of judges bill, it'll go up to $35,000.
Representative Taylor.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question earlier, Sam, was to find out from the lady what she thought she was gaining by passing this legislation. Right now, today, any person who is physically injured or has had damage to his property, that's the subject of the first paragraph, can go into a court in the state of Alaska and can seek actual and punitive damages under three or four different categories of law. Trespass, damage to personal property, and this is civil. I've got to turn it on. And this is civil. Hello. And
I can hear you.
Okay, good. And this is a piece of civil legislation. We currently have in the civil laws of the state the opportunity for anybody to go into court and do this. And that's why other than the administration or the commission wanting somehow to put a different title on suits brought so they'll be easier for them to track them and build numbers with, I don't see it. Silly thing that we do to change law at all or to increase the penalties on people at all. You've got the right now today to walk in and ask for punitive damages, and you'd probably get them if there was real strong evidence of bigotry or harassment activity taking place. You'd probably get some punitive damages.
Can I just put a question there? Could you show in your suit, if that's the case, could you bring in evidence of intimidation or harassment because of sex, sexual orientation, race, creed, or any of these other aspects? I mean, are those admissible in terms of proving actual damage or...
As soon as you raise in your pleadings the issue of punitive damages, and you have every right to plead those. You have the right not only to do that, but also then to even look into the financial ability of the defendant to pay your punitive damages on discovery.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with Representative Taylor, but under a series of cases from the Alaska Supreme Court, the Sturm versus Day versus Sturm Ruger case, to get punitive damages, they have to be actually related to the amount of the actual damages, and they can't be like treble damages. They're very, very limited, and you've got to show clear and convincing evidence because of the new statute. Under the amendment I plan to propose, number one, it's like going to be like an antitrust situation. Because society places so much opprobrium on this type of conduct, and I'm not sure whether it's going to say shall be awarded or may be awarded, I want to think about that, but we're talking in terms of getting treble damages. And right now, there is nothing that allows treble damages in a case like this. But I personally think it's sufficiently serious we ought to do it. And otherwise, I have a question whether you really do need to have this statute.
Well, I want to ask a follow-up, but in terms of hooking your punitives to actuals, I'm not aware of anything in the state. You could get $1 in actuals and get $10,000 in punitives. There doesn't have to be a relationship as far as I know.
But you take a look at the Day versus Sturm Ruger, the second decision in that, and that admittedly there were some substantial actual damages, but they were like $100,000 or $200,000, and the amount that was awarded was something like over $1 million.
$4 or $5 million.
Yeah, it was way up there. And so if you look at the language of that Supreme Court decision, it really ratcheted the amount down. So it was very closely tied to the amount of the actual damages. And admittedly, it wasn't a defamation case or anything like that.
I disagree with that interpretation, though. I have discussed at length from Ruger with several people, and we have a theory that we call it the cloud theory. One cloud passed over the Supreme Court, first Sturm Ruger case, they grabbed a number. The second cloud goes over, someone reached up with the omnipotent hand and grabbed another one. And there's no more relationship between those numbers and what actually took place in the case, the man on the moon. It may very well be a ratcheting down occurred. In the case, they don't say the ratcheting down occurred because the actual damages were X amount. They talk about all kinds of other things. My main concern here is that we haven't even discussed yet today the 1886 civil rights legislation. Was it 1876?
1893.
The number of...
Yeah, the Civil Rights Act.
Okay.
Anyhow, that allows for this type of litigation to be brought in federal courts, too, which does provide. An additional cause of action has been utilized successfully in this state in various cases of discriminatory conduct. In other words, I don't see a problem that we need to solve, and we certainly aren't solving anything by this legislation, other than adding a new category of civil offense for actual damages and putting into statute the word punitive, which isn't in statute, but we know is in the court decisions, and until such time as we do pass a statute saying no punitive damages. I mean, the tort reformers are going to come in here and scream like crazy about that one. Well, how do you buy liability insurance, as an example, to ensure your municipality that it's not going to be guilty of sexually discriminating against someone who's pregnant or failing to hire someone because of their religious background? And you've also included now, legislatively, the word punitive damages. These things have a much broader effect than just let's all get up on a liberal kick and go worry about whether or not we're going to beat up on the Nazis, you know? We all want to beat up on the Nazis. That ain't the question.
Mr. Chairman?
No, just a second here. Is there anybody else here in the room that needs to testify to this bill before we really get into a heavy discussion here? Gail, Sherry, you guys just watchers. Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Max.
I think we're going to need to deal with this on a future date. I was wondering if we could at least get back to the other bill and pass that out today. We have 15
minutes. Haven't even gotten to my questions yet. So, Janet, do you have anything you want to wrap up here? We're obviously going to have another hearing on this bill someplace.
Right, and I have been taking copious notes. I certainly am sensitive to the concerns of Representative Taylor. I know he brings his judicial experience, and that certainly offers great insights into the bill. However, I intend to find out for Representative Taylor what other states have such legislation, and I will get with Representative Greenberg and consider what I see is his attempt to make the bill a more meaningful piece of legislation. And finally, I guess I would say that I do think the bill has merit if it only defines acts of physical injury to persons or damage to persons of person because of these discriminatory reasons. This kind of activity is not covered under human rights law. It has nothing to do with physical injury that we presently would deal with in our discrimination statutes. It's totally separate, and it's directed at different kinds of activity, which I think deserve attention from the legislature. So I will keep in touch, Mr. Chairman, with the wishes of the committee for additional hearing. I will let the Discriminatory Harassment Task Force know, and I'll come back with a little more homework.
Okay, thank you, Janet. I think also I've asked both you and our House staff here to get us a list of other remedies available at law and existing law now that may cover some of these issues. That issue has come up, and maybe we need to take a look and see where does this bill add on to anything that is in existing, or does it detract from it, or what are the other options? So if you could give John Hartle a call on my staff, and you could work together on that.
I certainly will, and I appreciate your cooperation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Taylor, if you would also please contact me concerning the criminal aspects of this. I'd rather see us have a criminal section and deal with them in that fashion, as opposed to dealing with a civil fine against some redneck that doesn't even own the pickup truck he's driving around. I mean, that isn't going to do us much good.
Well, we certainly would appreciate your assistance on that. As I said, this was a fallback position for us, because originally what we wanted to see was a criminal statute that would call these crimes for what they are, which is malicious harassment or discriminatory harassment. And we are certainly looking for that to happen ultimately. If that can be done this year with hope of passage, I'm sure that the commission would be thrilled. We've just not been successful in that in the last two attempts.
Okay, well, I'll have Representative Gruenberg remind Representative Taylor of the discussion we had last year on the criminal aspects of it. So, with that, thank you, Janet.
Who was that,
Representative? We'll be signing off.
All right, thank you again.
Okay, 121, Max, you wanted to...
Yeah.
We left off with Representative Barnes had some copious comments to make on this. 121.
Can we ask Mr. Reske to join us?
Sure. Gail, you want to...
Thank you.
Three.
I'll just be, I got everything to do.
Naomi. Gil, if we repeal this statute, let's say that Representative Taylor brought false charges against me. And those false charges resulted in prosecution of me, and it was later found out that, in fact, the charges were false. Is there any remedy at law being left once the statute is repealed that would make him liable for the cost plus cleaning up my good reputation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnes, I'm happy to be able to say the answer is yes. In fact, there was just a passing reference to it in the transmittal letter. There are what are called torts. It's a term of art, but it's remedies for wrongs which are done to people. And way back at common law, even in England, and cause of action, as I understand it, have survived for malicious prosecution, false arrest, defamation of character, things of that sort. So that if you could prove, what you would do is file a civil complaint against him, alleging your various causes of action, and then it would be up to you to prove in a civil case with a lower standard, preponderance of the evidence, that he maliciously said things about you which he knew that were not true, and he maliciously caused actions to be taken against you which hurt your business or, you know, which damaged your reputation in the community, then you can get both actual and punitive damages from him as for the harm that you suffered. I don't know what the new tort legislation that maybe would scale that punitive down, but anyway, those causes of actions have survived, you know, since hundreds of years ago in England and continue to survive to this day and stay alive.
Yeah, I think you'd have a lot of civil actions. We're not on this. A lot of civil actions to remedy that. Representative Gruenberg, then Taylor.
Yeah, we're not on this.
No.
Ms. Oreski, I just want to have you consider my question about the letter of intent.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to look at a footnote in a case called Fire versus Fire. F-I-R-O-R versus Fire. It was a criminal contempt for non-payment of alimony. And Justice Matthews, in his decision, left open a couple of questions. And I think one of them was whether there ought to these criminal contempts ought to be prosecutable by private parties. I'm not certain. I just want to be very certain when we repeal this statute that you can continue to enforce it, particularly in family law cases, by criminal contempt, because that's a real important remedy, as Judge Taylor here knows.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd
be glad to do that, Representative.
And let me know, because if we do need to have a letter of intent, I wanted to put one in.
Be glad to do that.
Representative Taylor?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the question I had was on a somewhat divergent line, but that was recently, in the last year and a half or so, Department of Labor Licensing Division has received complaints concerning the conduct of one of the professions that it regulates. It then attempted to exercise its disciplinary discretion regarding one of those professionals, failed in the prosecution of that case. The professional then turned around and brought a suit for malicious prosecution and slander against every one of the witnesses who were the parties who had called in to the department complaining about the conduct of this professional. The state then found itself in the position, because it had called them as witnesses and was carrying their case forward, found itself in the position of basically having to pay the costs of defense for these parties on the civil suit brought by the offended professional. Then the state reached a negotiated agreement, and each of the parties, all these little witnesses that had come forward complaining about this, what they thought was gross conduct, when the state fell flat on its face and were unable to prove the case, then they ended up having to pay damages to the doctor whose, quote, reputation is injured. And my fear is that part and parcel with removal of this would be removal of the obligation, and Gail, please correct me on that one, too, if I'm wrong here. Would be removal of the obligation of the state to protect by paying the defense costs of those people who are sued because they in good faith come forward thinking they've got a problem.
Mr. Chairman, if I might inquire, do you know, was the original action a civil licensing action?
Yeah. It was brought by the Attorney General's office against us, though.
Mr. Chairman, this statute that we're dealing with today deals only with criminal prosecutions. So I don't think it would have any interaction or effect whatsoever in that context where you're dealing with a civil licensing action and what state liability, if any, was there for people whom they brought in as witnesses. That would stand or fall on its own merits based on common law interpretations and such like that. It wouldn't have any effect at all, nor would repeal this statute have any effect at all on the merits of that proceeding and the state's obligation or non-obligation.
I guess, okay. Gail, could you briefly tell us why the governor's put this bill in? What's the impetus behind it?
This statute has been on the books since the 1800s, and at the time it was first put in, we believe, and it's hard to do research that far back, but we believe it was put on to make it clear that people who brought malicious prosecutions would be held accountable for the costs of dismissing the action and any costs that the person had incurred to defend himself against the charges. This thing has been sitting quietly on the books for 100 and some years. In the past year or so, we have had about five or six different actions in the Kenai area where individuals have gone into court and purported to file criminal actions against other people. I think five out of those six were against police officers who had arrested them and alleging, you know, trespass and violation of their rights and assault and threats and stuff. And then the DA's office had to go in and purport to dismiss this purported complaint. And the court's going, well, what do we do with this thing? And it was the court system, Mr. Chairman, I want to emphasize, that came to us and asked us, Department of Law, would you be willing to put in this piece of legislation? I recommend it to the governor. And we were more than happy to, because our poor Kenai prosecutors were going nuts down there trying to figure out what to do with some of these people. So it's just a problem which has come up and we're afraid might spread. Until we had this problem, the statute just sort of sat there and vegetated for 100 years, but now there is an apparent problem. We should take care of by repealing the absolute statute.
So that applies to the case, if I bring a case into you, I want you to criminally prosecute somebody, and you don't think there's enough evidence, or for some reason you say no, which happens all the time.
Uh-huh.
Under that argument, I could go out into this case and file a criminal complaint myself.
Well, our position is that you could not. Our position is that you could not, but there are people who point to this statute as allowing that option or vehicle. To
now, I obviously can obviously prosecute or file civil charges against them, sure. I guess. But Representative Taylor?
I believe under this authorization, a private citizen may very well have the right to bring a prosecutorial action on his own behalf. We've gotten all the prosecutors. We've always had that. However, if you want to pay the cost and carry the burden, I think you have the right under this thing to bring a criminal cause of action in the name of the state. Now, and I really question, as long as that's on the books, whether or not the DA's office has the right to dismiss it. In Kenai.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, our position has been that this statute, which is, as I said, 150 years old, was... You have to read it in concert with AS 44 or whatever, the one that was adopted in 1949, which sets forth the powers of the Attorney General, one of which is prosecute all violations of the criminal laws of the state. Our position is that whatever power may have existed at common law that was codified in 1850 when we were territory, that power has shifted to the Attorney General under our modern system of publicly hired, publicly accountable prosecutors who work for the Attorney General.
That's what I'm getting at. Our Constitution is a document that's been dusted around now for 200 and some years, too. And the mere fact that it's old doesn't mean it isn't enforced. There was a reason for this law. And a prime example I can give you is a businessman like yourself gets stuck with about a $3,000-$4,000 bum check. And you pack it downtown and say, hey, Mr. District Attorney, prosecute this rascal. And they say, oh, that's a civil matter. And we hear that quote a lot. That's a civil matter. We haven't got time for that. And you say, okay, what am I supposed to do? Well, you've got your right, your civil rights. Yeah, you can go into court and get a judgment. That and four bits will get you a cup of coffee. Instead, you say, wait a minute, I want this rascal thrown in jail. And it's because of prosecutors who were not being in tune well enough with their communities that you ever had this kind of law in the books to begin with. If you want to pay your own costs, take on your own case, you could.
I got a good example. I called the guy and asked him to do just that. He said, no, it was her daughter that wrote the check. And usually what happens is right before it goes to trial, they pay up. And I said, fine. But otherwise, they wouldn't do it because it was, they just, even though it was against the law and they could, they just made a decision not to prosecute under those circumstances. And I would like to have, now if I'd have known about this,
you think it's going to spread.
There is one circumstance where this statute could be used, and that is back to the criminal contempt. Let's say you have a family of kids, hard feelings by both parties, a question concerning, for example, visitation, and the thing that's really going on is that the husband doesn't like the wife because she's cleaned him out financially. And he brings a non-meritorious order to show cause against the wife why she hasn't allowed him visitation. It's clearly harassing. The question would arise, at least possibly, since this is a criminal case, can he, when he gets ultimately that order to show cause dismissed, but he's found innocent of the contempt, not found not guilty of the contempt, can he get his court costs paid? Under this present language, at least theoretically, he could say, hey, I'm entitled to my actual court costs because, she would say, I'm entitled to my actual court costs because this was a malicious prosecution. Now, I don't think that that's a very good argument, because I think you can always do that in a civil, in a divorce case anyway. But other than that, I don't see any possible reason for having this on the book.
The people who have been sued and prosecuted, quote-unquote, against it, if you just think about the power that would be vested in a private person who doesn't have the ethical constraints that a public prosecutor would have, being an attorney who's acting for a private party has an ethical obligation to put his client's interests first and not step back and be a disinterested prosecutor whose goal is to see justice done rather than obtain a conviction. And you would have a bunch of hired guns out there filing criminal charges left and right against whoever they're having a dispute with at the moment, and that is not too far-fetched. We had one of the ones that this was prosecuted, quote-unquote, was himself charged with a felony crime, and he turned around and filed a misdemeanor, quote, prosecution against the victim in that crime. It's just nonsense. They're filing things back and forth. Anybody that can sign his name can file a criminal charge, and then you have to spend the money and suffer the community reputation of defending yourself against this, quote, criminal charge.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's why I have this statute that we're repealing is the only safeguard that victim, so to speak, has. And that says, right, if we look at the law right underneath the cover letter, it says the name of the person who voluntarily appeared before judge, magistrate, grand jury to prosecute a person in a criminal action, either for a misdemeanor or a felony, shall be endorsed upon the complaint, etc. If it is found by a judge, magistrate, whatever, trying the action or hearing the proceedings that the prosecution is malicious or without probable cause, those facts shall be entered upon the record, and the judge or magistrate of the court, and upon making such entry, he shall immediately render judgment against the private prosecutor for the cost of disbursement of the action.
Back to my question.
That means if you've got somebody maliciously coming into court, harassing local police officers with these specious charges, that the judge who sees that, after he's held a hearing on it, can immediately award judgment against him for being a private prosecutor and acting in an improper fashion. This is a protection against that.
Is it also the only reference to private prosecutor on the statute?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, maybe the other
so
way.
Get rid of one, you get rid of both.
That's what they're trying to do. See, and I don't know.
They're using the fact in the statute that there's a remedy for misusing private prosecution to justify that they have a right to private prosecution. Maybe the remedy here is to pass,
no,
instead of repealing this, is to pass a statute saying there is no right to private prosecution in this state.
But if you repeal it, that's what you do. See, the first sentence
says,
yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think it's pretty clear from what they're doing here, and I don't see any purpose to be gained by further discussion unless somebody has an amendment. I'd move the bill out.
Objection.
The motion to move the bill with individual recommendations and objection. Representative Taylor.
my objection is solely that I think this is a very serious constitutional right. It's been out there for a long time, and even though it isn't used very often, as Mr. Navarre said earlier today, though we haven't used the criminal thing on OSHA in 10 years, it doesn't mean it shouldn't be there. We shouldn't increase it by 100%. As far as I'm concerned, that right to a special or private prosecutor is a constitutional right. We ought to leave that right in there, and if you want to work on the bill, I'll be happy to, because I think we ought to specify how people should know that there is such a prosecutor, and whether or not they should be allowed to do it should be left up to a judge to make that decision or some objective party. And then if in fact those people act in an improper fashion, they ought to be nailed right there by the judge at the time. That's not a bad law.
I just think it's something that hasn't been used and it's been misused. I don't think it's a constitutional right. I think the state acts on behalf of the people, and I call the question. Let's go.
Well, question?
Question.
I'll get back to my original question, because I think there is a little bit more to this bill than meets the eye. And I'm not sure, you know, we want to move it out just quite that fast.
You can stop it. You need 4 votes to move the bill, so if you vote no, it stays in committee.
Okay. No.
No.
Yes.
Okay, we'll hold the bill here until tomorrow.
What about posse comitatus?
I'm also, for the record, going to hold...
No.
What do we got? 125. Hold it for tomorrow until I can make up my... find out on the schedule where we can fit it in. It won't come up tomorrow, but just to hold it to a date.
But this other one will.
This other one comes up tomorrow, yeah.
I'm taking both.
53 is gone. Meeting's adjourned.